From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. After much anticipation, the Obama transition team released a report on contacts between the president-elect staff and Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. The five-page memo says there was no improper contact between the two. Will that put the matter to rest, or will the Blagojevich cloud follow Obama to the White House? Vice President-elect Joe Biden says he'll be a different vice president. His approach, he says, will look nothing like Dick Cheney's. And Obama is still officially president-elect, but it seems like he's already president, doesn't it? Let's turn to our political pundits. Joining us now are Mary Frances Berry and Robert George. Nice to have both of you back with us again.
Happy holidays to everyone.
Let's start with this, the Blagojevich report. President-elect Obama's transition team releasing their report yesterday detailing staff contact with the Illinois governor. And as we said, their conclusion, no inappropriate contact after all. So, Robert George, why do I get the feeling that this isn't really the end of this?
Because, Tony, you've been visited by the ghost of scandals past, and you know that these things are never over until they're really over. This obviously was the self-generated, the Obama team's self-generated report on their contacts with Blagojevich. And so we basically have, in a sense, their word to accept it for what it is. And, you know, hopefully, because, you know, we're moving into a new administration and we don't want to have a scandal clouds hanging out. Hopefully everything there is accurate. And given that President-elect Obama spoke with Prosecutor Fitzgerald and so forth, basically as a witness in Blagojevich, we're assuming that there's nothing he said there that is in conflict with anything that's in that report, and that's the best that we can hope for. Yeah. However, if there is any kind of a conflict, you know, heaven help us, because we'll have this headache to linger with us for quite a while. Months to come.
Well, that's the question, Mary, isn't it? How credible the report is, given that it was compiled by Obama's own team and that it was released on one of the slowest news days of the year.
Well, I think that the press will probably give the Obama team a lot of slack as he's just coming into the administration. But as Robert says, anybody who's been around for a while knows that they put it out on Take Out the Trash Day, which is when they put it out on Friday, that every administration does that. And they did it when he's away, so he doesn't have to answer. They did it when Emmanuel is on his way to a trip to Africa with his family, so that they're all out of pocket, and they leave the vice president here, as usual. This always happens, to be the person to answer anything. And also, we get a result, which is not surprising. We didn't expect them to have a report saying that we did something improper.
Absolutely.
We've been nice for Christmas, you know. We haven't been naughty.
Yes, right. This all fits the usual script to whether it goes away or not. Fitzgerald, the prosecutor, is helpful because he said that no one in the administration is a target. Nobody on the White House team is a target. However, this thing is going to drag on simply because Blagojevich doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And so the investigations and the comments will continue. Also, I think that our friends on the Republican side, if history is any guide to what Democrats and Republicans do to each other, will continue to make an issue of it until every fact and every jot and every tittle
has been turned up.
All right. So,
you know, in just quick defense to the Republican side, I will say that there has actually been a number of Republicans who have been, in a sense, giving advice to the RNC and to others to basically hold their fire on it. John McCain has said that. My former boss, Newt Gingrich, has said that. I mean, I think everybody has been a little bit wiped out over all of the 24/7 corruption that's been going on over the last few years, and they want, and unless there's something obviously egregious that comes out, they want to try and give Obama the benefit of the doubt going into the new administration.
Well, he's definitely getting that.
Unfortunately, Robert, Newt Gingrich and John McCain don't tell some of the other folks in the Republican Party, especially some of those newer senators, including the one from my home state, Senator Coker, doesn't tell a lot of those people what to do, and some of the House members who are feistier.
But I don't think
that they will deliberately go out and try to make that number one on their agenda. They've got other fish to fry, including the stimulus and other things. But I do think that they will hold that as something that they can bring forward and look to be careful to see that nothing else emerges.
Let's move on to another topic. Let's talk about the vice presidents briefly here. This week, there was sort of the battle of the vice presidents on network television talk shows. The first, Joe Biden, appearing on ABC with George Stephanopoulos, talking about Dick Cheney in not such a pleasant way. Here is Biden.
I think we should restore the balance here. The role of the vice president of the United States, as I see it, is to give the president of the United States the best, sagest, most accurate, most insightful advice and recommendations he or she can make to a president.
Now, Dick Cheney came on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace to take a few digs at Joe Biden. Here's Cheney.
If he wants to diminish the office of vice president, that's obviously his call. I think that President-elect Obama will decide what he wants in a vice president. And apparently, from the way they're talking about it, he does not expect him to have as consequential a role as I've had during my time.
So do either of you, Mary or George, see Biden having as much power as Dick Cheney had?
Well, I don't think he'll have as much visible power. I don't know what'll happen behind the scenes, but it is true that vice presidents really don't have any power except to go up and preside over the Senate if they want to and to vote if there's a tie, so that they are whatever the president decides they will be. And George Bush decided that Cheney would be powerful. And so far, it seems that Biden has been a participant in the transition talks. He's supposed to run this middle-class task force, which vice presidents always run some task force or other about something or other. And whether it comes to anything, it depends on the vice president and what the issues are. And he also is around to take the heat when there are questions about something like this investigation and the like. But it does seem to me that whatever he does behind the scenes, Biden, I mean, giving advice, that because of the Cheney bad taste in most people's mouths, I don't think he'll be as visible in trying to take charge of anything.
What do you say, Robert?
I think that's basically true. Though we have to keep in mind that the vice president's office didn't, in a sense, just become this big, solitary power just overnight. There had been an increasing amount of presidents giving more, at least behind the scenes, authority to the vice president. You saw that with Mondale into Bush 1, particularly with Gore and the Gore Clinton relationship, and then of course Cheney took it to another level. I have a feeling that because of the way Obama has organized his cabinet, there will be a little bit of a pullback because, for example, Cheney involved himself in a lot of behind-the-scenes foreign policy and national security issues. When you've got a very, very powerful person with their own sense of political authority, like a Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, a Robert Gates in defense, they will, in a sense, play off of each other, and Biden would not, in a sense, be able, I think, to get his own fingers into that. But Biden, of course, has his own way of looking at the world and has his own way of speaking out, maybe not at the most inappropriate times, and so he will certainly have a certain amount of influence there, and hopefully to the good.
Let's end with this. Our time is short. Let's talk about Obama as president. It seems to me, and in my memory, I can't think of any president-elect who has been as presidential as Barack Obama. Can either of you think of anyone?
No, he has been involved in almost everything. I mean, every day there's either, except for now when he's on vacation during this period, there seems to be, there's a press conference or an announcement or a comment or a call for comment or the transition people talking about this and that and the other. And one could argue that it's because of the economic crisis that faces the country. But in fact, he has been out there almost eclipsing Bush, or you could say it was because of Bush's low poll numbers. But in a sense, it's sort of unprecedented.
It is certainly unprecedented, and it definitely has to do with the whole confluence of events that we're focusing on. focusing on. But I think also to give a little bit of credit to George W. Bush, that Obama could have the press conferences and things like that all he wanted, but if the sitting president didn't see how tough the times were to, in a sense, allow Obama to give Obama the stage, as it were, and to cooperate on a number of other levels, he could have made things a whole lot more difficult. But I think it's definitely a reflection of the times. And also, you know, President Bush has invited President-elect Obama, you know, to have dinner with the other living president as well. So
why not the dead ones?
What?
let me end. that's a good line for you. Let me end this with you, Mary, because our time is up, and I want to wish both of you a happy holiday. What did you think, really briefly, of that photograph of our president-elect bare-chested on the beach in Hawaii?
I thought he looked buff.
Did you?
And I thought he was quite attractive and buff and athletic looking and vibrant looking, and I certainly hope that whatever is going on inside his body is as good as what the look was of what's on the outside of his body.
Oh boy, that's why I had to ask you that question.
I can't add anything to that. I think he may need to work on his upper strength.
All right,
you know, the chest area needs a little bit more tone, I think. But otherwise,
we got to go, Robert. Otherwise, people are going to think that you are hating on the new president. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Robert George, associate editor, editorial page editor for the New York Post. Thank you both very
Merry
much.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays.
Happy Holidays.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. This week, the blogosphere is buzzing with holiday spirit and a lot more, from Barack Obama and hip-hop to Black Santas and Kwanzaa. On today's Bloggers Roundtable, we've got political analyst Lenny McAllister. He blogs for several sites, including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web, and LaRue Lewis, assistant professor of sociology and Black Studies at the City College of New York. He blogs at UptownNotes.com. Welcome, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of the nation. Yes, we can. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists.
The new president is already having an impact in the music world, as evidenced by songs like this one from Will.i.am. The website The Daily Voice published an article recently about Barack Obama's popularity in the hip-hop community under the headline, "Obama Won, Now Pull Up Your Pants." The essay argues that some very prominent rappers like Young Jeezy, Rick Ross, and T.I. have begun to change their tune in response to Mr. Obama's victory, and that they've set aside their message of drugs and guns in favor of a more political tune. Felicia, let me begin with you. Do you think that Obama's election will have a substantive impact on rap music?
I think it'll have an impact. It's not going to completely change things overnight. I do enjoy being able to hear a greater diversity of topics and themes in different rap songs. We're still going to have that negativity. The negativity is still going to exist. But I think what will happen now is that we'll hear a broader range of things spoken about in rap. I love the fact that I can hear Yes We Can on the radio and it's popular and that young people are embracing it. And hopefully they'll continue to embrace more positive messages. But it's up to us to continue to push those positive messages and make sure that they remain profitable as well, so we can have that balance and not just hear about the guns and the bling bling and all that in rap.
What do you say, Lenny?
Well, I think that what we're going to have to look at is the Obama phenomenon within the hip-hop culture. Is it going to be a trend or a movement? I mean, everybody has been saying yes, we can, including the hip-hoppers out there, but we need them to be able to say yes, we will, and then after a while, we need them to be able to say yes, we have, meaning that something has gotten done. Right now, it's trendy to have Obama shirts, Obama paraphernalia, and to be on board with Barack Obama becoming the president, but we need this to be a life-changing event where it actually changes a plethora of lives, not just American history. That's where the key is going to be in with the next, not just 100 people talk about 100 days when it comes to politics, but for Black America, it's going to be the next 2 years, next 5 years. What type of impact is it going to have? What type of root is it going to take?
Well, LaRue, Reverend Al Sharpton recently said, quote, "You cannot be using the B word, the N word, the H word when you have Barack Obama redefining overnight the image that Black people want to have. Here's the greatest political victory in the history of Black America," he says, "and the thug rappers cannot come near it. They will have to change or become irrelevant." Is he right?
I think Reverend Sharpton is absolutely wrong on that approach. The day of the election, I heard people using the B and the N and the H word on the train, right? I think people understand that this is a moment where we engage politics, electoral politics, and we hope for a candidate. But that doesn't mean everybody's life shifts instantaneously. Reverend Sharpton's had an attempt to try to, quote unquote, clean up hip hop, make people pull up their pants and not cuss. But hip hop fundamentally is a music form that really lives and thrives off of resistance. So we have to resist that which is always accessible or acceptable, but also do it in more complicated ways. So I think Reverend Sharpton is definitely off the mark on this.
Let's go into this a little bit deeper. During the presidential campaign, it was widely publicized that Obama's camp denounced rapper Ludacris for what it termed, quote, "outrageously offensive lyrics" in his song "Politics, Obama is Here." Here's a clip.
"You never should have doubted him. With a slot in the president's iPod, Obama shouted him. Said I handle my biz and I'm one of his favorite rappers. We'll give Luda a special pardon if I'm ever in the slammer. Better yet, put me in office. Make me your vice president. Hillary hated on you, so that bitch is irrelevant. Now Jesse talking slick and apologizing for..."
Now similarly, Young Jeezy's recently released song "My President is Black" has become a sort of anthem for some people while spawning anger and embarrassment in others. Here's a clip of that song.
"Tell them I'm doing fine, a bummer for mankind. We ready for damn change, so y'all let the man shine. Stunting on Martin Luther, feeling just like a king. Guess this is what he meant when he said that he had a dream. Black, my Lambo's blue. Now we got damn in my rims ain't true. Mama ain't at home."
All right, now, Felicia, to follow on LaRue's point, one of the bloggers that we talk about has written, quote, "Are you kidding me? Hoes with no clothes and thugged out images are not going anywhere. All the newsstands have all the hip hop magazines with naked Black women exploited and sexualized, proudly displayed. Nothing will change." What do you say?
I wouldn't go so far as to say nothing will change. He has a point. And like LaRue said, it's not going to change overnight. And as long as the hip-hop artists have a right to express themselves, they're going to continue to express themselves in whatever fashion they see fit. So he's right. I don't think it's going to go away overnight. I don't think it's going to go away ever, honestly. But I do think that we'll have more positivity, and maybe we'll get to a point where young people will look and they'll be able to choose between some of the negative messages they're receiving and some of the positive messages they're receiving, and choose to be more receptive to the positive ones.
All right, let's go on to another topic, because there's a lot of things that are changing as a result of the election of Barack Obama. On the blog Jossip, there was an article that talked about the big three Black leaders who need to go. That's in quotes, namely Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan, and Al Sharpton, according to this blog. LaRue, what do you think? Do we need to put some of our older Black leaders out to pasture now? Is it a new day?
I don't think we need to put them out to pasture in the sense of now that Obama's been elected, we have a Black leader. Both Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and Louis Farrakhan represent a grassroots approach, and the grassroots have always been there to challenge mainstream politics. When Sean Bell gets murdered and the police get acquitted, Barack Obama says, "Okay, everybody accept the verdict. Justice has been spoken." Whereas folks like Al Sharpton stand up and say, "Police brutality is not right. Killing an unarmed man is not right." So these Black leaders that many people criticize are actually the folks who are fighting for the most disenfranchised and poor amongst our people.
Do you think, Lenny, that we're looking at perhaps a generational shift from older to younger African Americans in terms of leadership?
Yes, I think not only are we looking at it, but we absolutely needed it. If you look at these three leaders, none of them are under the age of 55. You look at the civil rights movement, you look at when we rebelled as slaves, and everything leading up to this point of time, the leaders were young. They were under 35. They had energy, they had life, and they had vision for the future. Now we're being led, as far as Black leaders go, with these three. You're talking about Louis Farrakhan, who's over the age of 75. You're talking about Jesse Jackson Sr., who talked about cutting Obama's genitalia off. And then you're looking at Al Sharpton, who has a shady past in and of himself, regardless of the good work that they have done, every significant movement in the world, even if you look at the greatest generation here in America, it was World War II. Those were not led by just 60-year-olds that were running the war. That was a war and a generation that was crafted by people that fought the war, then came home and helped build out suburbia and everything else. In Black America, we need young Black leaders that are going to stand up and take the place of these three leaders. They do need to step aside, in my opinion, and hand over the mantle. The problem is, greatest generation as Black people has been the civil rights leaders, but now they are of age and it's time for them to pass on their wisdom, something that they have not done effectively, onto younger leaders who are going to take up that mantle and move us forward, grabbing the hand of people such as President-elect Barack Obama to help Black America and subsequently America move forward from here.
Well, Felicia, one of the things that, in addition to the generational question, is the gender question. The three leaders mentioned here are all men. And Condoleezza Rice in the Bush administration was the most prominent African-American woman in government. How do you see the change, if at all, coming through Barack Obama's presidency for women as far as leadership roles in the Black community?
Well, I definitely hope it's a situation where Black women leaders are in a position where they're able to affect more change. We've always been leaders. We haven't always received the kudos as necessary, even going back as far as the civil rights movement with the Big Seven, how a lot of times Dorothy Height didn't get the credit that she deserved in her efforts with the civil rights movement. I hope that with change comes a more gender acceptance, because Black women are out there and we're doing the thing. And it becomes an issue of a lot of issues that affect African Americans also affect women too. And I think we're in a position now where Black women can take more of a role of leadership. I with a lot of the appointments that President-elect Obama has made with a lot of Black women to more prominent positions, I think we will be in a position to make more effective change.
All right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai Tadea. With me on today's roundtable are Lenny McAllister, who blogs for several sites, including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. Felicia Harvey, who you just heard, who is the editor of Black Politics on the Web. And LaRue Lewis, who blogs at UptownNotes.com. All right, let's talk about this for a moment. This has to do with hair. Earlier this month, the Boston court decided that a Rastafarian man who refused to shave his beard or cut his dreadlocks for his job at Jiffy Lube can sue the company for religious discrimination. Now, the Rastafarian faith urges followers to let their hair grow unbridled to express a oneness with nature. So here's what one blogger says. For the first time since this hair politics discussion started, I think the employer might be right in asking the employee to get rid of the dreads. Jiffy Lube is not an office building. It's an auto shop, meaning it contains a lot of whirring machinery that could easily snag a dread. Now, I don't know if any of you have dreads. So, Lenny, what do you think? What do you think about this?
I don't have dreads, and there's a point to be said about the office building, and there's two sides of this coin. It's a very interesting one, because one aspect of it is Jiffy Lube has an image that they want to protect when it comes to how they address their consumers, and if that offends or affects how they can address their consumers as far as their brand name, they have a right to at least ask for that. And then there's also a safety issue, even though you can sign a waiver to get around that. Yet at the same time, if you go to a Jiffy Lube, let's just be real, I mean, there are people in there with tattoos, or there are people in there with different types of earrings and piercings and everything else. At auto body shops, you're still talking about mechanics. So if somebody's keeping hair because of their faith, if you look at the Nazarites, if you go back even to the Bible, they never cut their hair. They never drank wine or anything else along those lines. So there is a religious foundation to what this case seems to have to it. So there's definitely going to be an interesting interpretation of the law and of what rights the company has and what rights the individual has when it comes to this. It's very peculiar.
LaRue, black hair is a hot topic in the U.S., has been for a long time. Some say this lawsuit has more to do with making a statement rather than religious discrimination. You buy that?
I think it's both. It's a statement and religious discrimination. I have had dreadlocks and been told when applying for jobs, if you want this job, you have to cut it. So the ways in which Jiffy Lube shifted the policy, it's important that we see that people are making decisions to eliminate certain folks, right? Ask him to be a second-class employee. We have separate but equal facilities that you could work in. And it's also important that he's bringing this case and continuing to fight it. Even though some folks look and deny and say, well, he should just cut his hair, we don't want to make people compromise their personal beliefs. Most most Rastafarians actually keep their hair covered. So the whole question of it's dangerous and he's working around machinery, he's been negotiating with his hair for a long time and he's done it successfully. So we have to make sure that corporations and companies create cultures that are acceptable for diverse populations.
All right, we've only got a couple of minutes left for this edition of Bloggers. And Felicia, I want to talk about another person who has long hair, Santa Claus. And yesterday on this show, we had a very interesting discussion about black Santa Clauses and Latino Santa Clauses and Asian Santa Clauses versus white ones. Is this something that in your own experience you've had to deal with as far as either your children or relatives or being interested or concerned or not concerned about whether Santa Claus at the mall is black?
Well, I don't have any kids, but I think it's great that we're getting to the point where we're diversifying Santa Claus in the mall. I know growing up, I was familiar with the black Santa Claus, but the black Santa Claus is only at the black bookstore or other black establishments. So it's great that now black Santa Claus has been let out. They let him in the mall. It's interesting that we're talking about it now, but I think there has been a trend shifting towards having more black Santa Clauses, more Asian, more Hispanic Santa Clauses for the past couple of years. And it's at a point where you almost have to do that. We live in a multicultural society, so there's no reason why we should expect our Santa Claus or our superheroes or other fantasy characters to only remain one particular race.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We do talk about Santa Claus a lot, and we're tomorrow, well, actually not tomorrow, but on the day after Christmas, we get into the beginning of Kwanzaa. There's not as much talk about Kwanzaa, is there, Lenny?
No, not as much, because there's still a knowledge gap when it comes to Kwanzaa. There's not the economic stimulus to talk about Kwanzaa either. But truth be told, the difference, I think, between Christmas season and Kwanzaa is something that we should be carrying around all year long. Christmas, because it's been commercialized, gets into the snowflakes and the snowman and the gifts and everything else, where Kwanzaa, if we can really take, and this is an opportune time with Barack Obama becoming the next president of the United States, if we can take the principles of Kwanzaa, celebrate that African holiday now and let it transcend how we live our lives moving forward. Everything that we touched on during this segment, from how hip-hoppers will move forward to how we address each other to even things such as having more women leadership in black America, all of those things can come about quite easily because Barack Obama was able to break the glass ceiling.
I'm not going to put you guys on blast by asking you to name the seven elements of Kwanzaa, but I'm going to share them with you and with the audience. There's unity, self-determination, collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. So we've got a black Santa Claus in some places. We've got Kwanzaa. We've got Christmas. We've got Hanukkah. I think I've covered all the bases. And if I didn't, have a happy whatever it is that you celebrate during this holiday
season.
You missed
the most important one, which is we have a black president-elect. That's the best thing about this Christmas.
Well, there you go. We've been talking with Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web. She was at member station WUSF in Tampa. Political analyst Lenny McAllister, he blogs for several sites, including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. He was at member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, and LaRue Lewis, assistant professor of sociology and black studies at the City College of New York. His blog is uptownnotes.com. He was at our New York studios. Now, you can find links to their blogs and to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop there. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about and to find out how. Go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. Thanks, everybody. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Here's another listener favorite from 2008. As part of NPR's series In Character, a look at the fictional American characters that have had an impact on our lives, I took a closer look at a stubborn, argumentative, inner-city junk man named Fred Sanford. That's right, it's Fred from Sanford and Sons. But as a warning to our listeners, we will be airing clips that use strong language, including some racial epithets. Take a listen. It was the winter of 1972 when Sanford and Son was introduced to America's primetime TV audience on NBC.
Oh, is this the Ace Plumbing Company? Yeah, well, this is Fred Sanford. Sanford, as S-A-N-F-O-R-D, period, speaking.
Comedian Red Fox was cast by producers Norman Lear and Bud Yorkin to play the gruff 65-year-old curmudgeon Fred Sanford, with his trademark suspenders, gravelly voice, and scraggly beard, Sanford lived in a Watts junkyard with his son Lamont, played by DeMond Wilson. Fred's intimate and often emotional interaction with Lamont offered a slice of black family life rarely seen on network television at the time. Bud Yorkin.
The character between the son and the father was very interesting to me and to Norman, in the sense that despite the fact that they lived together and complained and so forth, what was interesting to me was the fact that they couldn't live without each other. And so that's what we based the idea on.
How would you like one across your lips?
The idea for the show was actually based on a British television comedy about two London junkmen called Steptoe and Son, but with one major difference. Both Fred and Lamont were black.
All right, now we got rid of the stuff and everything's been taken care of. You happy?
Happy. I got a truckload of copper at the bottom of the ocean. I'm out of $40 and I'm sitting here with my dummy son. I didn't know a black man could be so happy.
That created challenges and opportunities for Fred and the rest of the show's cast to break new and sometimes controversial ground. Black audiences were crucial for the show's credibility, but white audiences had to embrace Fred Sanford if the show was to succeed.
You can't do a show that's dealing with Afro-Americans that the Afro-Americans don't like and don't want. And you don't want to do it so that it's just the Afro-Americans love it, but the other people don't want to see it. So you have to go in between.
Hey, Pops, how you feeling this morning? Feel with my hand like I always did.
Fred Sanford's wit, down-home honesty, and sometimes acerbic comments were a hint of the actor who played him. Prior to his role on Sanford and Son, Red Fox was an established nightclub performer, famous for his adult humor.
Here was a guy who went to the doctor. He said, Doc, look at here. Doc said, you ever had that before? He said, uh-huh. Doc said, well, you got it again.
As Fred Sanford, he toned down his humor for television, but according to show writer Paul Mooney, he toned it down only so far.
Red Fox's character was too arrogant, too uppity. The things that he did and said, please, he could get lynched for less in Mississippi. Now, let's not try to be naive.
I'm driving along a street in Hollywood, see? All of a sudden, there's this woman standing out by the curb, messing around in the trash cans in front of a house.
White woman?
Yeah. Pop, this woman was about 90 years old.
Ain't nothing on earth uglier than a 90-year-old white woman.
It was written to be undignified.
Black television historian and author Fred McDonald says while Sanford and Son was groundbreaking, it was also dangerously reminiscent of the crude and unsophisticated African-American characters portrayed on the 1950s television show Amos and Andy. The difference, McDonald says, is that Fred Sanford successfully tiptoed the line between minstrelsy and mainstream comedy.
He was always, you know, attacking, slashing, a little bit out of control and scheming. So in that regard, you could put him in the line with the characters such as George Kingfish Stevens from Amos and Andy. But at the end, he was offset by the positive characters around him. And that balanced it.
Characters like Aunt Esther, Fred's Bible-toting sister-in-law played by LaWanda Page, who gave as good as she got.
Aha!
Where'd you come from?
Where you think I come from?
Under a rock.
You can't talk yourself out of this one, you two-timing beady-head weasel-eyed fool.
Like Norman Lear's seminal 1970s sitcom All in the Family, Sanford and Son also tackled taboo topics. In this clip, Fred takes on a prejudicial justice system with his distinct homespun philosophy and language.
Why don't you arrest some white drivers?
I do.
You do? Well, where are they? Look at all these niggas in here. There's enough niggas in here to make a Tarzan movie.
Sanford and Son producer Bud Yorkin remembers Red Fox campaigning to use the N-word in that episode.
He said, let me do that stuff. I want to be able to say that. And I said, well, you know, I don't feel comfortable with it, but if you feel, I can do it. You can't do it. I don't want somebody else doing it, but I can do it. So I said, well, okay, Red, you know. And he did it. And by and large, we never got any complaints.
Indeed. The show's blend of comedy and controversy lasted for 135 episodes over 6 seasons. For 5 of those seasons, Sanford and Son was among the country's top 10 rated television shows.
You know what I've decided to do? I'm going to do missionary work. Probably be going to Africa. I'll be doing work among your people.
Not mine, my people in St. Louis.
Today, Fred Sanford is still wobbling around his junkyard on arthritic knees via syndication 36 years after his network debut. But what draws younger viewers and old fans to the little junkyard in Watts week after week? The junk man who ran it, says Bud Yorkin.
You felt more for him than you did for his son, because after all, the son was young, and you didn't want to hear him complain to the father, and he ruined it. I had a date tonight, and you bring in 3 guys that want to sit down and play poker with you. And why, how can you do that to me, Dad? And we get into a whole scene. Well, you feel sorry for the father more than you do for the son. But there was no doubt that they loved that character.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the best dressed man of all? Give me my answer and make me contented. Make it quick, because this suit is rented.
The good news is that Black America is steadily running out of firsts. I offer up the first Black president as Exhibit A. It seems the challenge now is becoming more about how not to forget the people who blazed the trails. In this case, I'm talking about Diane Carroll. This year marks the 40th anniversary of Julia, the show that made Ms. Carroll the first Black woman ever to star in her own television series. This is the theme music from that hit show, which ran from 1968 until 1971. For our ongoing series, Living Legends, NPR's Farai Chidea spoke with Diane Carroll. Farai wanted to know what Julia means to her today, now that she's seen and done so much more.
I'm very proud of it. I look back with great pride. We had major, major problems when we went on the air that I think were expressed by both communities, Black and white. And we survived. I think it was 4 years we did on the air. And I look at it from time to time, and the quality is there. It's charming. And I thought the casting was excellent. So as a product, I think it's a good product. I'm happy to be there.
So for people who don't know a lot about it, you were playing a nurse, a mother. You even had your own doll well before most of the sort of customized Barbie-style dolls. You became a little figure. And it was one of those moments when there were so few Black characters starring on television. Did you take this role and think about how many people would be looking up to you as a role model because you took that role?
No, I've never done that. I took it because of the work. I took it because I liked the work. I think that's the way an artist should select a part. I wish that was the way producers selected the artist, because the artist is correct for the part. But I did feel that it was something I wanted to be a part of. The fact that it turned into something that became, as you say, a role model was not something I concerned myself with. If it happens, it's, you know, one of the perks.
Tell me a little bit about who you were as a person at that time.
I was a young mother. I had worked very much on Broadway and in nightclubs. I traveled a great deal. The thought of being in one place for a period of time was very appealing. I wanted to do something that I felt was important, and this provided me with all of that. I was able to make a home so that my daughter and I could live together, and I could work and have some semblance of organization, of a normalcy, which doesn't happen in show business very often.
Normal is a description that's different for different people, but you have had some of the most amazing experiences in the world, from playing Norma Desmond to being on Dynasty as Dominique Devereaux, and having a few marriages.
Four.
Yes, four. That's quite a bit of experience.
Yeah.
And so when I think about you, I think of glamour. You personify a certain type of glamour. How do you think of yourself?
Now, today, you mean?
Yes, today and in the past, if you like, but I was thinking just in general.
I think of myself as a wife, a mother, an actress, a singer, a child. All of those roles are part of my life. It's a very rewarding, complicated life.
Before I turn to some of your work with the issue of breast cancer and caregiving, I want to ask about another role. There's a movie, Claudine, and it really brought together an amazing cast, you and James Earl Jones, and it was a film that kind of cut against a lot of the popular wave was some of the blaxploitation cinema. You were nominated for an Oscar. What was that film like to work on, and what does it mean to you today?
It was a great joy to work on that film. I had never worked with James Earl before, and he really outdid himself, I think, in that film. It was a project that I was very happy to be a part of for many reasons. It coagulated with my friend, whose name is Diana Sands, was. She helped to make this thing become a reality. And then she passed away just before they could finish their first week on the film. And so my obligation to her, because we had known each other since we were in elementary school, was uppermost in my mind most of the days of my working on the film.
Oh, I'm living like a queen on welfare, you know.
You're jumpy.
Well, my kids are fine. You don't need to be worried about my kids.
Oh, no, I'm not worried about your kids. Not my problem.
That shit all the time from the welfare, always asking me to apologize for my kids. You know what? I don't have to explain that to nobody. Now, you just pushed the wrong button.
Okay, I was just asking.
The other thing about this was that I was so happy to break away from the glamorous beaded gowns, and this allowed me the opportunity to be someone really from the ghetto. It was important to me because that too was a part of my life. I was raised partially in the ghetto, and I knew it well, and I wanted the opportunity to do that and to make that happen on screen, and I did. It was a wonderfully fulfilling time as an artist, really.
You yourself are a breast cancer survivor, and now you are a champion for the people who you call stars, who are the caregivers. Take me back to the moment, not necessarily when you were diagnosed with breast cancer, but when you knew you really needed someone to help you and that you had to make a sobering realization that you wouldn't be able to deal with this on your own.
I think my friend, my star, my caregiver, realized before I realized that I would need that kind of support, that kind of loving, I'm here for you support. I had not faced any major illness in my life. And so when she arrived and planned to spend the entire day, I thought it was a very wonderful thing to do. But after I received the information and I learned that my cancer was malignant, she really brought tears to my eyes because she knew that I didn't really know what I was getting into. So she was there so that whenever it occurred to me that this was life-threatening, that she would be there to hold my hand. So when I learned that the wellness community was involved, and I've been involved with the wellness community now for over a year, and they've decided to publish this book, it's called The Balancing Act, and the goal of this book is to provide information and hope to cancer caregivers. And usually the caregiver puts the life that she's leading or he's leading on the side while they decide to take care, be a friend, hold your hand, maybe even change your diaper. During the illness that you're going through, that's quite a commitment on the part of any human being towards another. To decide to honor them and to say what we need to say every day, which is thank you. I really don't know if thank you is enough, but you're a magnificent part of my healing, and I want you to know how much I honor what you offer to me. That's what this whole program is about. It's about our learning how to be grateful to those who give up something to make us more comfortable or more knowledgeable about what we need to know. This book is available. It's available through the Wellness Community, or it's thewellnesscommunity.org. So I am endorsing the fact that we need to express our gratitude towards our friends.
Diane Carroll, I want to say that many people thank you and many people love you for what you're doing. I appreciate talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
That was Farai Tadea speaking with living legend actress Diane Carroll. 2008 marks the 40th anniversary of the show Julia, the first show in which a black woman played the lead and title role. That's our show for today. Thanks for being with us. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the reason for the season. We'll talk with a volunteer who has given the last 10 Christmases to help those in need. I'm Tony Cox from all of us at News and Notes. Have a happy holiday.